Brigadier Armstrong, Reel 3.
Well, now, to go back to Wana Camp, I've got to mention our water supply. There was a big well on the plain there, which had been dug and arranged for by previous units some years before the war and things like that, in what we call the fort. It was surrounded by a mud wall. Oh, it was a fairly big place. And the sappers had built inside that fort a squash course, which was still playable on, and was a great help for people who wanted a little extra recreation. And we also had a swimming bath in there, which our sapper company had repaired, and was available and very useful in the hot weather, especially on Sundays, where people go up and have a bathe and just talk, etc. Now, rations. Periodically, a convoy would come up from Manzai with our rations. It would be, the road would, what you might say, it was opened. In other words, the politicals were responsible for safeguarding transport on the road between Manzai, the base camp where we'd left, and Wana, which we had reoccupied out on the Wana plain right up on the frontier. Now, the system of guarding that was, one might say, blackmail. There were what you call kasidars. Each section of tribe on the road from Manzai up to Wana had a certain area that they were responsible for the safety from raiders coming over from Afghanistan, from bad-tempered fellows in their own tribes, and they received payment through the political officer. They weren't actually under the military command. They were under command of the political officer of that area, and he would, of course, accept advice from the military to which points were vital to be occupied by kasidars to prevent sniping of the ration convoy coming up. Where there was a thing called the Shahur Tangi, which was about 6 miles long. A river ran through the Tangi, and there was a road built on the side of the cliff mountain, and a narrow road and a very tricky part to negotiate if you ran into trouble there. That is where our main danger lay. And we used to have these armored cars to help see the convoys through this part of the world, or the country. Rations would not come up daily. We couldn't afford that. I can't remember now, but I imagine they'd come up about every third day. The road would be opened, and the rations would come up. Now, at evacuating personnel, they generally went at the same time as a ration convoy. But it is possible, or was possible, in cases to have the road opened, as we called it, by the political, to warn the political officer that it was essential that we sent down a certain amount of transport, say sick people, or visiting inspecting generals. The viceroy came up. Actually, he flew up, incidentally. But the commander-in-chief, I think, came up by road once. The divisional commander. I don't think the commander-in-chief, he flew up, I believe. General Burwood, or Field Marshal Burwood. Occasionally, you had an unfortunate incident where some bad-tempered man would let off a rifle to someone. If he thought he'd scored a bull, he would then make haste to cross the plain and go into Afghanistan, where, of course, he was quite safe. We couldn't get at him there.
One of the kasidars.
Yes, it would be, generally it would be a kasidar. They were, on the whole, they were loyal, simply because they paid. If they weren't loyal, they didn't get the money. And they preferred the money than, shall we say, having a shot at us, I suppose, in those cases. Columns went out. We talk about a column. Well, now, we went out from Wana to the Afghan frontier. About half a mile from the actual frontier, we camped there for 2 nights. and of course put out our posts and had a perimeter, not a fully full perimeter as you'd have in our permanent camp, because it'd take too long. We anyhow had frontier posts out, just showing the flag. It was in the summer, and we had about 12 or 15 miles of this stony plain to march across, and it was very trying, very, very hot indeed. And I think there wasn't a British battalion. They'd have had some amount of heat exhaustion, I think. We couldn't delay. We simply marched 3 miles or an hour and 10 minutes halt across there. No repercussions from Afghanistan. I suppose they weren't even prepared for us coming out there. Or if they were, they had no reason why they wanted to have a fight with us. But it was just showing the flag and showing that we could get to the frontier if they wanted us to go there. Other activities, now, other than the ordinary routine communication from Manzai up through the Shahur Tangi onto the Warna Plain. And very, very seldom did we ever have any trouble from the local wazirs. I must mention, there were the South Waziristan scouts. I don't know where they were enlisted from. Anyhow, that was the scout organization was on the frontier, and their job was to occupy certain forts which had been built near the road, near the communications. They lived there. They had British officers, and I don't know where they enlisted them from. They were completely separate from us. They were paid, I think, by the civilian, not by the army. The army officers were seconded to South Waziristan scouts. They were their own masters. They went out on gushtrous patrols every day, probably. They'd send a gushtra patrol, might be a whole platoon, might be 20 men or so, 10 miles out, roundabout, see everything is peace and quiet. They were a great help to us indeed, if there had been any trouble. And when the convoy ran through with rations, they always sent out a certain number of patrols to see that part of the country where they were was peaceful and quiet.
How many years were you on the frontier altogether?
On the frontier, I was there 3 years. Oh, no, four, I beg your pardon, 4 years. 4 years.
This was, what, 26 to 1930, was it?
It must have been, yes, I think it was, actually, yes. Yes, I finished my tour of duty up on the frontier. I started 26, I think about 26, and spent only about 6, 8, 9 months down in Manzai, and then we moved up to Warna. Yes, that's right.
And this, in general, was a peaceful time?
Oh, yes, yes. I can't be bloodthirsty, it wasn't. It was peaceful because you were careful, because you put out your protective screens, because you had your strong points, because people walked about with loaded rifles. You were prepared for trouble, and they knew it. And there was no object of them causing trouble. They were the only ones who would be the losers, really. I'm talking about the Warna area, that's what I'm talking about. Up at Rusmark further over, occasionally they had little trouble, but on the whole, it was a peaceful time on the frontier, definitely. We had no trouble from Afghanistan at all. It was all local trouble, either Marsouds or Waziers.
What was your opinion of the Pathans?
Pathan? Oh, he's a magnificent fellow. Fit, he's a good fighter, he's very brave. Oh, yes, no flies on him. If he doesn't want to behave, he won't. He will misbehave if he wants to do so. He's only one loyalty, and that is to his tribe, to himself, his family. We had occasionally, we got one of the locals into our hospital up at Warna. You can expunge this story if you like, but it's on the tape. We had admitted to the hospital one summer Wazir man and a Wazir woman. Now, the man had a rifle bullet through his two thighs. Went in on the right thigh and came out the left thigh. The woman had a bullet hole through the two cheeks of her bottom. And that's what happened. In other words, we better turn this off. Do you see?
You mean they'd been together?
And the husband had come upon them in the act, you see, and shot them. There. No, I better scrub that. It was the other way about. The man had the bullet through his bottom, and the woman had the bullet through her thighs. They were lucky not to have been killed, actually. But he'd got a sense of humor, the husband, apparently. And we just had to treat him. I don't know what happened to them afterwards. They left us. It caused a great deal of amusement, I must say.
But didn't you find that the Pathans were treacherous?
They got a reputation of being treacherous. I cannot recollect... depends what you mean by treachery. But I cannot recollect any occasion, when they were treacherous to us. There may have been, but anyhow, it's passed out of my recollection now. We looked on them as treacherous, and therefore we weren't careless. We were always prepared for trouble. We always had some form of protection. I mean, we didn't go wandering around without some protection being there. We had gardens in between this, and the photograph I haven't got, between this Gibraltar picket, this high ground where there's always a permanent picket there, of about a platoon strength there, and the camp. There was a river, and they had made gardens there. They made a tennis court there. I think they made two tennis courts there, things like that. Yes, they made a 9-hole golf course there. But they were always protected. There were always troops up in Gibraltar Picket, or if necessary, troops out there or here with rifles or Bren guns, whatever it may be, prepared in case of an attack. But this particular area wasn't occupied by the Waziers. They hadn't got a village there, you see. Their village was away from the Warna Plain. So it was unlikely that we should be attacked. Anyhow, we'd have got warning possibly from scouts or someone if was some big operation was envisaged by the Waziers. No, we were always prepared, and as a result, I suppose any tribe wanted to make trouble, they realized it just wasn't worthwhile doing so.
Did you have any training in India for being called out in aid of the civil power?
No. There were certain regulations the British battalion always got, but I can't recollect. Mark, when my battalion was up near the frontier, Rawalpindi, and that we always had cards. Every officer had a card, which in case he and his unit, whatever it may be, platoon or company, called out in the aid of civil power, he was accompanied by a magistrate. Always, he might be a white man, might be an Indian, and before he could take any, shall we say, punitive action or fire a rifle, he had to get the fellow to sign this card to say that you are now authorized to take the necessary action. Words to this effect: you are now authorized to take the necessary action to suppress this riot or stop this particular action taking place. It is more than your life was worth, shall we say, to take action without getting the card signed. You'd be in awful trouble if you had.
Were you ever called out yourself in aid of the civil power?
No, I was never. I was up on the frontier for all the time that my battalion was in Rawalpindi, which was not very close to the frontier, but it was in a position to be used for frontier duties if necessary, but was more for local trouble if there'd been riots in Rawalpindi village or town, I mean, or anything like that. They could call out a company of troops, possibly. There were actually two other British battalions there, so it might be another battalion called out. But as I wasn't with the battalion for most of the time there, I can't say that they were ever called out. I never heard of them being called out for riot duty.
Whilst you were in India, did you ever see any evidence of any political activity by Indians? Any demonstrations or posters or anything like that?
No, I must confess, no. Rawalpindi, no. Lahore, which was, might be looked on as a troublesome city, no. And down at Faizabad or Dinapur, all very peaceful and quiet. No, I must confess that there may have been occasions when some troops were called out for some particular purpose. I have no recollection now, over 40 years ago. I never was called out. I only had the frontier job, where one was automatically prepared for trouble. But down in the other stations, it all was very peaceful and quiet, really. I can't recollect any troubles at all.
What did you and the other officers think about the activities of Gandhi and the other Indian Congress
leaders? Oh, we thought this is tripe. I mean, we thought a bloody awful lot of fellows, really. But we never had any contact with them. But we thought that it's a poor show. I mean, we weren't very sympathetic with them at all.
Did you, whilst you were an officer in India, did you think that British rule was going to end soon?
You know, the British officer in India in those days wasn't politically minded. You know, we didn't really discuss this. We might have had a few remarks on the mess. We weren't briefed about it. We were untroubled by it. We enjoyed our life out there. A few Indians we met seemed very happy, or up in the hills, seemed to be no trouble. I thought it was a very happy life, really. British battalions, of course, didn't talk the language by and large. You see, practically no officer in my battalion, I say practically no officer, rarely learnt any Hindustani at all, any Urdu. There was no necessity for us to learn the language, really. You could try and do so if you wanted it, but I don't know if they'd ever be called upon to use the language except when talking to your servants or your bearer, that sort of thing. I used to talk Hindustani to my bearer. Well, he understood me, I know, but it was very much pidgin Hindustani, really. It was sufficient to tell him what to do and tell him what he'd got to tell other people to do. No, I think there seemed to be no real incentive for the British officer to do so. I think one or two the bits of language, but we didn't have contact with the Indian soldier, do you see? They had their own officers. You didn't want to interfere. You couldn't interfere. There's no point in interfering with them. One very seldom met any Indian soldiers. I'm talking about my own point of view, do you see, on my own personal experience. I had more contact, shall we say, than other officers in my battalion, simply because I happened to be a staff captain of an Indian brigade, a brigade which was all Indian troops, with our own officers, of course. I didn't issue orders. The only orders I'd issued to Indians would be, really, the brigade police. The Indian soldier in the battalion, I wouldn't dream of issuing an order to him other than through his own officer. I think they'd resented it, definitely. I'm sure they would have. But no, things were very peaceful. I don't think I was ever expected to interfere.
So you didn't really think that British rule was going to end soon then?
Think. I suppose.
Or did you we not did, consider
we didn't
it at
worry
all?
About it. You see, we knew. I suppose. I think we didn't think that Gandhi was going to kick us out of India. This was before the Second World War. You see, when things changed very considerably, we left India about 8 years or so before war broke out, and I don't think we were worried, or I don't think we discussed in the battalion very much the political situation, other than thinking that Gandhi was a blinking nuisance, or that sort of thing.
Did you think that British rule was a good thing for India or not?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't think I'm biased. I thought the British had done marvels for India. I do, really, I think so. I thought the Indian Civil Service was a marvelous organization by devoted English people. I thought the political officers, the few I met, or that, or by reputation, were a dedicated lot of officers who they're really engrossed in their job to do all they could for the Indian. Oh, I had the greatest admiration for the white officer out there. Now, I don't mean military officer, I mean the white civilian who was doing a job. We didn't rub shoulders very much with them because they had their own areas. In your military cantonment, you hardly ever saw, rarely, a civil servant, because he would probably be down in the civilian cantonment, in the where the other white people, ICS, worked and lived, and the other people.
Didn't you meet them in the clubs?
Oh, yes, a certain number. But there weren't. You see, take Rawalpindi, for instance. The military were very much more. The population, I mean, stronger. There were all the battalions there and the military there. And there were very, very few civilian administrators there. Or we came across very few of them. But those we met were very nice. But we weren't really, it's not even like an Indian battalion, we weren't really concerned with them. If the brigade may have been concerned with them, and down in Pindi and Lahore and those places, in Delhi and so on. But I'm afraid, and I say it now, I'm afraid that the English battalion, we weren't troubled by it. We didn't think about it, really. We enjoyed ourselves. We hoped we were polite to people. And we didn't throw our weight about. Well, no one had taken any notice of us. We did, I don't think. We were just very happy. And we thought that India was very well run. The railways ran well, which we'd put in there. The roads were repaired, very dusty possibly. But everything seemed to go very well indeed. We could go down and shoot. And no difficulty about that, if you were interested and wanted to do so. Or you want to go up to the hill stations, Missouri, or places like that. No, I don't think we were ever worried in any way about it. We just accepted a normal life was going very swimmingly, very nicely.
Did you ever go hunting big game in India?
Yes, I was very lucky. I got 2 months leave when I gave up the staff job. And I got 2 blocks, what you call it, large areas of forest, one I used for each month. And I had a very good time. I went down there with my bearer, and there was a forest. He wasn't an officer. He was just a forester who was helpful, who was in charge of that particular block. And he would know the areas that why I'm talking about big game shooting. But anyhow, there was plenty of opportunity to get big game shooting. It was, wasn't expensive. It was interesting. It was enjoyable. I was very lucky. I got two tigers in each block, and I got, I think, two leopard in one and one in the other. Or panthers, they were called. Sorry, leopard Kenya. The panther is the same breed with a different name in India. No difficulty. You lived rough, of course, very rough. That is up to you entirely. You lived in the tent, had your bearer who looked after and fed you. And you had these hunters. No, they weren't hunters, really. They'd advise you where water could be found, and you always went down near the water to find your tiger.
Still, I'm not talking about tiger shooting now.
Well, if you want to know about the cub, well, I used to like wandering out in the jungle by day, hoping that I might come face to face with a tiger one day without him coming up behind me. And I was wandering around not very far from my camp, and I came round the corner, and in front of me, about 100 yards away, was the side of a hill, a small hill, with two holes, which are obviously small caves. And to my astonishment, I saw in one of the entrances a tiger lying on its back with its paw up against the roof of the cave. Therefore, the cave is very small, and only about 3-foot entrances. I thought, good heavens, you're a lucky man. I then stood absolutely still for a moment and saw about, this tiger was probably about 100 yards away, about 50 yards from me, in between the tiger and me, was a fallen tree. And I thought, if I can get to that fallen tree, I can kneel behind it and take a very steady aim at this animal, shoot it. Just as I had approached the tree, it must have heard me, or instinct told him that something was up, because he suddenly jerked round onto his forepaws and looked in my direction and saw me, and for a moment stared at me. I had just time to take aim and shoot, and I was lucky to kill it with the first shot. But to my sorrow, shall we say, as I shot the animal, a cub ran out from the cave. Small cub, it must have been a month old, something like that. And I thought, of course, this poor animal will die. It'll either be killed by some animal, or else it'll die of starvation, because it was too young to kill for itself. So I sent one of the boys with me back to my camp to get a blanket. And my bearer, I fired a second shot. I always, whenever shooting a tiger, always put, although I know it's dead, I put a second shot into it. It may not be dead, if possible. And my bearer in camp, I said, the Saab shot a tiger and he killed it because he fired two shots. So he's prepared for me to come back or to get him, like that. So the boy ran back to camp and got my bearer and a blanket. Then we had a chase round the jungle to cover this cub with my blanket. I fell on top of it with a blanket in between me and the cub, smothered it, because it got very sharp claws, incidentally. And four of us got hold of the four corners of the blanket and managed to carry this cub back to camp in the blanket. It couldn't climb up the side of the blanket, but it was spitting fury at it and clawing the blanket, all right. When I got back to the camp, I must have more or less covered it all over the blanket, because I put a collar around, a rope collar around its neck, and I put a rope and collar around its loins, between just in front of its hind legs, and pegged it, these two ropes, to the ground, so that the peg round its for the rope round its hind quarters wouldn't allow it to reach the peg which was in front of its nose, and the peg in front of its nose was put sufficiently